Hello, I'm Michelle Hanratty. Thank you for listening to Sound Optometry. Just a reminder that you will no longer receive a CPD point by listening to this episode of the podcast. But if you subscribe and listen to the most recent episodes of Sound Optometry, you can gain CPD points. I hope you enjoy this episode of Sound Optometry. Hello, welcome to Sound Optometry, the podcast from Docket that provides high-quality, continuing professional development for all UK-registered optometrists. You can gain one CPD point by listening to this podcast and completing the exercise on our website, docket.info. I'm Michelle Hanratty. I'm an IP optometrist based in Birmingham and an examiner for the college's scheme for registration. With case studies and in-depth conversations each month, we're exploring the topics that matter the most to us optometrists. In this episode, we'll be exploring some conditions that present themselves frequently to optometrists, but the most appropriate solution isn't always obvious. Of course, I'm talking about binocular vision disorders. We'll also address some of your questions following the recent Docket webinar on the subject with Dr. Alex Mankowska, an optometrist and lecturer in the Bradford School of Optometry and Vision Science.
In these sorts of cases, is the problem one of excessive convergence or one of insufficient convergence? And the cover test for me was the key.
And we'll explore which treatments work for specific people, like when to and when not to prescribe prism. But first, one of our producers, Dr. Hilary Geit, has been speaking to a patient about their experience of growing up with a binocular vision problem.
My name is Eleanor Blindman. I am 19 years old. I'm a second year child nursing student at the University of Bradford. I have convergence excess.
So let's start at the beginning. When did you first realise that there was something wrong with your eyes?
Probably at school. I had like lots of overlapping. Everything just seemed blurry to me. I was seeing double of everything. So I'd pick up a pencil, and if the pencil wasn't there, it was a bit further away.
How old were you when that happened?
Probably about 13 when I knew something significantly was like wrong.
And did that come on suddenly, or was it just a gradual build-up?
I think it was a gradual build-up, because I didn't notice it at first. And then when it became much bigger, that's when I started to notice it. Like, my eyes couldn't focus. I think my left eye was over-focusing, like, way too much.
And did you have headaches as well?
Yeah, there were a lot of, like, I called them pressure headaches as a result of them overlapping so much. It gave me massive headaches, like, all the time.
Ooh, that must have been tough at school.
My grades weren't very good. I had time off school because of the headaches. I couldn't really see much. I couldn't see close up and I couldn't see far away. There was like a gap in between where it was like, okay. It was a real struggle.
And what, you went to your optometrist?
Yeah. I remember the first time I went there, I had eye drops so that they could see right through, and that's when they knew something was wrong. You could see my eye physically turning.
So then what did they do to treat your condition?
They gave me some prescription lenses, bifocals, to try and reduce the amount of over-focusing of my left eye. Without them, I wouldn't have graduated high school.
So they worked?
Yeah.
How well did they work for you?
Straight away, I noticed there was a difference. I could focus more in school. I could see the whiteboard more clearly. My grades significantly improved.
Oh, well done. So what was it like as a young person wearing bifocals? Because we often think older people tend to wear them.
Yeah, everyone found it so strange to begin with, not only me. I was the youngest person you've ever seen with them. My geography teacher, who was in her 60s, had varifocals. So we always used to compare our glasses.
Yeah.
And everyone was like, oh, Eleanor's got the old lady glasses. And I was like, okay.
How often do you see the optometrist now?
I would say it's just a yearly review to go through everything, see how the bifocals are working, what can we do to improve them? Is your double vision getting lower? Would we look at reducing the strength of the lens to a point where your eyes can focus on their own?
So they think it might get better as time goes on?
I'm hoping so.
Gosh, that's great.
I feel like I've come so far from when I really couldn't see at all, and now I'm thriving.
Eleanor, thank you very much for sharing your story.
Thank you so much.
Joining me now is Alex Mankowska, who's a lecturer at Bradford University and is also Eleanor's optometrist. Hello, Alex.
Hello.
So, Alex, you work in a university eye clinic, so how did Eleanor actually find you?
They self-referred, in that I think they just were looking around for any help on the internet, and they found our services and made an appointment and came to see us. All we ask of our patients is that they have an up-to-date eye test, so at least we're starting with something, which she had, and then the rest we took care of in the course of her first appointments.
Okay. So had she not had much help from her own optometrist in the first instance?
I think that she'd had a prescription, which was really a very low hyperopic prescription and not much else. So single vision glasses, I guess probably because she was very symptomatic. I think the symptoms probably were building up over time. How much of an issue it was when she went to see her optometrist about 6 months earlier, I don't know. But I think she felt that clearly it just wasn't enough and she needed a little bit more, which is why she came to see us.
So in terms of her symptoms, was Eleanor a typical convergence excess patient?
I would say so. I mean, symptoms of headache, double vision, blurred vision, noticing that words just don't stay stable on a page. Yes, it can be convergence excess. It can also be a number of other similar or different binocular vision issues as well. So it's then important to make sure that once we get a good idea of all the symptoms, that we then do a close examination to make sure that we identify what is the exact cause. But yes, she would be typical.
Okay. And she did have a small refractive error, you said, but her glasses weren't helping, were they? Because she described her vision as being blurred both in the distance and close up, didn't she?
That's right, yes. And I think the problem was that once she was decompensated and she really couldn't bring back her convergence near under control, then I think it just affected her vision all the way around.
So her solution in this case was to have bifocals. But I imagine that quite a lot of optometrists might feel uncertain, a little bit unsure about prescribing bifocals or actually taking any form of refractive management for patients with what seems to be a binocular vision problem. So how do they know that that is actually the best way forward, as opposed to sort of starting with exercises, for example?
Well, I think the key to this is the fact that she was symptomatic. If we had maybe spotted a problem and it was something that we had picked up as part of the assessment, then maybe exercises would have been a first port of call just to try and manage and improve the situation. But because the patient is so symptomatic, she's having so many problems, the double vision was pretty near constant, you have to do something to try and alleviate the symptoms there and then, to at least give us some help so that then we can go on and manage the problem. And that would be the case, whether it's a refractive correction of additional sphere, whether that's plus or minus, or whether it's prism, whatever that management is, it's just to try and help relieve the symptoms. But I think even before we get to that point, it's important to make sure that the patient does have the right refractive correction, full stop, as a baseline before we go any further and make any changes or any additions to it.
So with Eleanor having double vision, why was prism not indicated? Because a lot of optometrists might think that actually double vision, prism is automatically the thing that you instinctively think will correct that, rather than giving a reading aid.
Yes, it might sound strange, especially for a 13-year-old girl, but unfortunately in cases of convergence excess such as this, the driver is the accommodation, and we can't really correct that with prism. We have to start with some form of spherical refractive management to try and control that accommodation, to try and stop the phoria from decompensating so that she can then hopefully be relieved from the double vision and have a better quality of life, really, and better vision.
How do you explain to patients and even their parents why they can't have varifocals or contact lenses? Because children might feel quite self-conscious wearing bifocals.
That's right. And sometimes it is difficult to accept that you have to have this lens that you would prescribe more for a senior citizen. But I think it's trying to explain to the patient that we're looking at correcting specific working distances, and we needed to make sure that she could work comfortably at her working distance rather than have a more generic correction. The other thing is the bifocal lens gives us a bigger working area of lens rather than a varifocal in which the reading area is very limited. So we have to balance out the cosmesis versus the practical management side.
Do you think there are any key lessons that we can take from Eleanor's case?
I think it's all around the cover test. I think in these sorts of cases, the cover test is the thing that gives you the clue as to what kind of problem we're dealing with. Is the problem one of excessive convergence or one of insufficient convergence? And the cover test for me was the key. And also in this particular case, I learnt that use the cyclopedic refraction not just to get the prescription, but also to go back and have a look at things like the cover test again, where accommodation is not active and we can see the full extent of any problem that a patient may have. And it was here where we really revealed that she had such a huge esotropia. It was something around about 25 prism diopters of esotropia. And that really came out to the fore during the cover test under cyclopegic conditions.
Wow, that's quite a big difference.
It was huge.
So binocular vision is a real battle of a topic for many practitioners. And what I'd like to do next is try and break it down a little bit into some slightly smaller digestible chunks. So let's start with, if a patient comes in with symptoms that include double vision, what are the key things that an optometrist must ask when they're doing history and symptoms?
Yes, I think that probably for me, the biggest thing is to make sure that what the patient is experiencing is double vision. In other words, that there are two separate images, because for a lot of patients, they may regard double vision as just a slight haze or a slight blur or ghosting around their main image, which could be then related to a whole host of other factors, potentially pathological, rather than issues that are specifically double vision. And I think this is true of both older and younger patients. Older patients, we could be dealing with perhaps the onset of cataract or something like that. In younger patients, when you start to question them and they say, oh, yes, I get double vision, and you say, and when does that occur? Oh, it's when I stare at something for a long time. So it's making sure that the double vision is a true separation of the two images, and then understand, do they get it all the time? Are there any associated factors? Is it a horizontal separation or a vertical separation? Any effect of the refractive error? And that just helps us to perhaps kind of start to narrow down and understand a little bit more about what's going on with the patient.
Mm. So once you've actually finished your history and symptoms and you're moving on to the actual examination part, what do you think are the baseline tests that we should be carrying out?
Well, we should be thinking about the sensory fusion status of a patient. So looking at doing stereopsis, thinking about the recovery movement that we see on the cover test, at the end of a cover test when a patient is coming back to binocular single vision. We should then move on to think about the alignment. So are the eyes straight, which obviously is the cover test, thinking about things like perhaps fixation disparity, near point of convergence. If possible, maybe even a little bit of fusional reserves to help us understand about the fusion. And then finally, look at the aspects of vision. And this incorporates the refraction and accommodation measures. So looking at the aspects of binocular vision and then aligning the test to that to say, these are the things I need to do.
And when optometrists do these tests and the tests fall outside of what we would consider normal, are there any extra tests that they can do to get more information to help them with their management?
I would think that probably we need to start to, first of all, go back to the basics, certainly looking back at the refraction. And here's where probably cyclopegic refraction should be everybody's friend. And then have a think about things such as dynamic retinoscopy to look at the actual accuracy of the accommodative response. So it's a very quick and easy test to do. One that I would actually personally, I do it as routine, especially if I'm dealing with younger children. But I know that for some people, this can be a second line of test. Looking at how well a child's or a patient's accommodative system responds to the stimulus. And we use dynamic retinoscopy to do that. If possible, if we can measure fusional reserves, maybe think about a 10 or 20 base out prism test to help us try and understand the system a little bit more.
And you also mentioned about fixation disparity as well. So people do have access to fixation disparity and distance charts. That's very common. But what about if you don't have a mallet unit, a near mallet unit?
Yes, it becomes a little bit more difficult then, because any tests, for example, carrying out a cover test, I suppose that would be our best option because that equipment is available to most of us. It isn't quite the same thing, although, I mean, both tests are very valuable and very valid. The big difference between a cover test and a mallet unit is the fact that with a cover test, we're actually dissociating the patient's binocular fusion, whereas with a mallet unit, we are actually trying to maintain that binocularity. So there's a slight difference, but I think if we don't have a near mallet unit, then just always revert back to a cover test because it just tells us so much about the patient's alignment.
And we've mentioned stereopsis tests. So do you have a particular favourite?
So the three tests that I use most commonly in the eye clinic are the Frisby test, the TNO and the Titmus Fly. The students who were coming to see me for competencies decided that the Titmus Fly was my favourite because I used to say that it was very maligned by a lot of optometrists. So they used to come to do their competency with the Titmus Fly test. I think that all three tests work equally well, give equally good results. I think for me, the most important thing is the practitioner being good at controlling the presentation of the actual targets that the patient's looking at. So making sure that keeping that working distance the same every time, making sure that they keep the book steady, just so that they standardise and they don't allow the patients to try and look for those monocular cues, encourage the patient to keep their head still as well.
Thank you. You're listening to Sound Optometry with me, Michelle Hanratty. Every month, we'll be exploring the topics that matter the most to us optometrists, and that's where we want to hear from you. If there's a topic you want us to cover or have a fascinating case you want to share, email us podcast@docket.info or tweet @soundoptometry. In practice, when we manage double vision, we are looking at anomalies of either divergence or convergence in most cases. Dr. Alex Mankowska, an optometrist from Bradford University, is with me to help make sense of this. And she's here to answer some of the questions that you and your colleagues asked after her recent Docket webinar. So Alex, how would you go about interpreting the results of the many tests carried out or formulating a management plan? So let's start with their refractive element first.
For me, it's making sure that the patient has the best corrected vision, which means a careful refraction, whether that's under cycloplegic conditions or not. And I think that the decisions that we have to make depend on the degree of refractive error. So if, let's say, we encounter a large increase in the refractive error from the patient's starting position, we have to make a decision as to whether or not we feel that giving them the full prescription or not is the right thing to do. Are they going to be able to tolerate it? Will they be able to adapt to it? And some of those questions are unknown. I think we can certainly make some of those decisions ourselves if we feel that we have to maybe step back from the full correction. Are we compromising their vision or the binocular vision status? Or if we feel that the full correction is the best way to go, then I think we have to explain that carefully and manage that carefully with the patient's agreement and say, if you're not happy with it, always come back in and see us.
Hmm. And then moving on to the binocular vision element of things. Is prism always indicated if the patient is still symptomatic with a refraction in place?
Well, I think that if we need to give the patient some instant relief, then that's what we have to do. For example, contrasting the case of Eleanor's convergence excess with perhaps somebody who has a poor control of convergence and convergence insufficiency. I had a case of another young man who came to us aged 11 whose NPC measured 50 centimetres.
Wow.
Yes, it was really bad. And for us to be able to even start any form of exercise, we had to bring that NPC slightly closer than the 50 centimetres because he was just never going to get off the starting block, really. And that would be a case where we would prescribe PRISM just to help the patient then improve their convergence through exercise. You don't want to ever over-prescribe the PRISM, so you have to be careful to give the minimum amount. Whether we use something such as a mallet unit or whether we go subjectively, perhaps, usually the target is held around about 40-ish centimetres away from the patient to see one or two basin of PRISM would bring that NPC closer to the patient and allow them to start exercising. And then we can go from there. And once the patient has a better control of their convergence, we can start encouraging them to exercise, perhaps without the PRISM, and then hopefully manage that PRISM down and take it away from them in the fullness of time.
So really, the pitfall to avoid is actually prescribing too strong a PRISM, isn't it, really? So always giving them the minimum amount that you can to get that NPC close enough to start the exercising or to maintain single vision at the distance that they require it.
Most definitely, most definitely. I think sometimes people feel that they can prescribe from, say, a Maddox rod or a cover test, and that's not the case. I think we should use something like fixation disparity as a way of prescribing the minimum amount of PRISM. Or if we want to do this subjectively, and sometimes I find that's actually easier to do because the patient can tell you the point at which you've relieved the double vision or brought that NPC closer, and that just sort of allows you to prescribe the least amount of PRISM.
So you could really do it with an RAF rule or with the N5 text or even with just a near vision test chart, couldn't you?
Absolutely, absolutely. You don't always need fancy equipment to do any of this.
Yeah. Now, some practitioners may be worried about PRISM adaptation. Is that a risk in cases like this?
Potentially, it could be. And this is where we require careful management of the patient. Unfortunately, it means that we have to bring people back on shorter recall intervals because we don't want to leave them for 6 months, for a year with that PRISM if we only intend it to be a very temporary measure. So we have to give the patient long enough to be able to manage and improve, but then also just long enough so that we can keep control and just watch over what's going on, monitor carefully. So we'd be looking at something like maybe a recall interval of 3 months, for example, initially to see how the patient is progressing and to see whether or not we can actually reduce the PRISM down or how quickly we can start to reduce the PRISM if that's what we've gone with.
So would you ever consider using Fresnel PRISMs then rather than having it built into a pair of specs?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, I had a case recently with one of my students at Bradford who was struggling to focus clearly through the slit lamp in his practical labs. And we found that he actually had a problem with his convergence and he was struggling with the exercises. He just couldn't seem to bring that convergence any closer. So we gave him a very low two basin PRISM. We fitted it as a Fresnel PRISM and it helped him both just bring that convergence back into place and it helped him with the exercises. And after a period of 4 weeks, we took the PRISM off. He was absolutely fine. So a temporary fix is sometimes useful.
And I suppose a Fresnel is quite a good way of demonstrating to the patient that it should be temporary. And because it is very visible, they're always reminded that it is supposed to be temporary, not a permanent solution. So I think using Fresnels can actually help to reduce the risk of adaptation, can't it?
Yes, definitely. I mean, it's not the nicest thing to see for patients, but it allows us to encourage them to work both with and without the PRISM correction when they're doing their exercises. So it is a useful alternative before we think about a longer term incorporation of PRISM into the prescription.
So what exercises do you normally recommend for convergence insufficiency?
My go-to is any form of pentanose type exercise. I wouldn't necessarily just tell a patient to use a pen because I don't feel it's a target that's sufficiently accommodatively stimulating. I tend to give them a copy of my fixation stick, my budgie stick, because it's got a variety of different targets on different pictures. Tell the patient to pick out details to make sure that the target is sufficiently challenging. And then because they've seen us do the actual exercise in the clinic, i.e. in the way that we've been measuring convergence, they can understand how to do that then at home and encourage them to do it 2 or 3 times a day, depending on the severity of the problem.
And how do you ask them to track their progress?
I tell them that they're always aiming to get the target as close to their nose as possible. And as they're bringing the target closer to the nose, the minute that they experience double vision, they should stop and pull it away. And they should hopefully see that the point at which that double vision occurs, if they're compliant and things are going well, should be closer and closer towards their nose with time, with progress. If there's a parent in the room, I will also bring them into the conversation. Tell them to put on a song in the background so it times the 2 to 3 minutes that you want them to do the exercises, and it allows patients to form a nice routine.
Yeah, it gives them a finite period that they know they have to do it for. So that's a really good idea, actually. I like that one. In an ideal situation, when should a patient be reviewed after being given exercises?
Yes, I think probably around about the 2 to 3 month mark, usually, just to make sure that they're progressing well, that they're compliant. We can probably tell them to reduce the number of times that they're doing the exercise over a day at this stage, and then maybe sort of even counsel them that if they reduce, taper it down to a point at which they can stop.
So finally, what are your take-home messages for optometrists that they have to bear in mind when managing binocular vision patients?
I think that probably we should, first of all, just take a good case history and symptoms, check the refraction carefully, and then just have a look at the basics. So do a good cover test, have a look at their stereopsis, have a look at their binocular control. Just start with the absolute basics and we can build on from there. If we do those things, if we do a cover test, if we do good stereopsis, a good motility, we can gain an awful lot of information about the patient's binocular visual status.
Thank you. And just one last question. Are there any particular resources that optometrists can go to if they're thinking, I need to refresh myself on binocular vision theory?
There are plenty of resources on the Docket website around. I know that there are good refresher courses, a few good textbooks, for example, Pickwell's. There are plenty of other examples like that. But just a basic textbook, I think, will get people a long way.
And there is a list of references on our website as well from the webinar. So I do encourage our listeners to have a look at that. Thank you very much, Alex.
Thank you.
If you would like more information about binocular vision, go to our website, docket.info, and search for sound optometry to find the additional reading materials. All GOC registered optometrists can also watch Alex's fascinating webinar on binocular vision on the Docket website. Just search for the binocular vision webinar from the homepage. There's also a link in the episode description on your podcast app. By listening to this podcast and completing the short exercise on the website, you can gain 1 CPD point covering the GOC domain of clinical practice. Over the next 2 episodes, we'll be looking at enhanced optometric services across the 4 UK nations, such as the Minor Eye Condition Service in England and Community Eye Care Services in Scotland. Until then, we'd really appreciate it if you help spread the word about the podcast. Tell your colleagues to listen or subscribe to the series so you don't miss an episode. The producers are Jason Hoskin and Dr. Hilary Guite. I'm Michelle Hanratty. Thanks for listening.